Joining us this morning is Craig Nelson, the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Craig Nelson, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Milt.
Well, this is a fascinating book. You take us on a journey, a historical journey, all the way back from the X-ray up to some of the modern concerns we have with places like Chernobyl and Fukushima. At the very beginning of the book, you outline just briefly some of the many ways that we as human beings are exposed to radiation, some natural, some man-made. After I read that, I almost felt like crawling in a bomb shelter somewhere. I don't think most people go through their day and realize how many different types of radiation there are in the world.
It's astonishing, isn't it? But before I answer that question, I just want to let your listeners know that, Milt, I do not share your disparaging, dismissive view of atoms. I don't think they're lowly. I think without atoms, where would we be? So anyway, let's get that out of the way. Well, 5 years ago, and in five dog years, I should say, before I started working on this book, I probably had the same idea that most people have about radiation, that it's very rare and it's very dangerous. That, you know, it's only in power plants and in weapons caches, and if you get touched with it by a little tiny bit, you get cancer and drop dead and have like six-legged babies and all that kind of stuff, right? So I was sort of shocked to find out that, first of all, it's all over the place. I mean, it's so prevalent we should call it organic radioactivity. It's rising up at us from uranium in the bedrock. It's falling down at us from cosmic rays. It's in microwave ovens and smoke detectors. It's in granite and clay and adobe and kitty litter. It's in your pets. It's in your friends. It's in your family. And it's in you. And every time we get together, human beings irradiate each other. So that warm glow you feel in the movie theater as you're enjoying a frolicking comedy, it may be just the feeling of everyone irradiating each other in there.
Now, your book primarily starts, I guess, with Wilhelm Röntgen and his discovery of the X-ray, 1895, I believe it was. Is that the first, as a society, as a people, that we really began to understand something about atomic energy, or did we have some inkling, some other scientists maybe before that?
No, that was really the start of the concept that within matter was energy. And so in that particular case, he didn't know it was matter. He thought he was making a vacuum tube. But what happened to him was becomes almost a template for the entire atomic age, because Röntgen is this totally washed up 50-year-old guy whose best years are long behind him, who's teaching physics at the University of Würzburg, which is an adorable but medieval town. And Germany may be the center of the scientific universe at that moment, but it's not Würzburg. So, like everybody else who becomes a famous name in science, he's a nobody working in the middle of nowhere. And that gives hope for us all. So anyway, Röntgen is playing with what he thinks is a vacuum tube, and he's putting these gigantic volts of electricity through it, and he's turning off all the lights to see what happens. And he finds that a little screen that's made with barium platinocyanide is on the other side of the corner of his office, and it starts lighting up every time he shoots these volts through this tube. And by accident, his hand falls in front of the screen, and he can see the bones in his hand. And he becomes so disturbed by this that he doesn't tell anybody what he's found for months. He thinks he's going crazy, and he decides that the only way he can refer to whatever rays are coming out of that tube is to call them X, which in science is, of course, the unknown. So that's where we get X-rays.
Well, some of the other early people that were prominent, of course, was Curie and Bohr and Planck and Einstein. Can you tell me a little bit about, after this initial discovery of X-rays, where the science began?
Well, what happened was that, what will happen with Marie Curie and radium, and then again with the atomic bomb, X-rays causes this enormous fad of public enthusiasm, and people get very excited about it. And then suddenly we find out there are side effects. And the first side effect, in fact, is Thomas Edison is trying to make an X-ray light bulb. And so he keeps the guy who's doing it is named Clarence, and Clarence ends up X-raying himself so much that first his arms have to be amputated, and then he dies at the age of 37 from leukemia. Oh, so people start finding out about these side effects, but they also find out that X-rays can be used to kill tumors and for other benefits besides the obvious broken bone one. So this will happen again and again and again with scientific discoveries. The same thing will happen with Marie Curie, who most people probably don't know really created radioactivity. It had been, the essence of it had been discovered earlier by a French colleague of her named Becquerel, but she really created radioactivity. She came up with the term radioactivity. She discovered two new elements, radium and polonium, and she and her husband discovered that it could be used to cure tumors because the radioactive rays have more of an effect on fast-growing cells of cancer than they do on the normal growing cells of healthy cells. But what Marie Curie's story you probably don't know is that her own daughter discovered artificial radiation, which is important to us today as the microscope in medicine because it's the foundation for an enormous amount of diagnosis and treatment. And because of that, her daughter, Irene, was the second woman to get a Nobel Prize, and Mom Marie was the first.
Yeah, I was a little surprised to see that. I think I'd heard of her daughter, but I didn't realize that they'd both won the prize. We are speaking this morning with Craig Nelson. He is the author of the book, The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Also, he's a best-selling author of Rocket Men, if you have read that. If you'd like to join us here on The Exchange and have an opportunity to talk to Craig or discuss some of these issues about radioactivity, radiance, you can call anywhere in the area, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send an email, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll take a short break and come back and talk some more about the history of the atom, which I promise I won't call Loli anymore. So join us right after this short break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with best-selling author Craig Nelson. The author of his new book is entitled The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. As I have read some of these stories about the early people in this particular branch of science, Craig, some of these folks are, I guess to put it favorably, unique, aren't they? It certainly attracted some pretty funny personalities.
There's an astonishing coincidence in that four of the greats of nuclear science are all Hungarians who all grew up a couple of miles from each other in Budapest. And they first had to flee anti-Semitism in Budapest, and they ended up being educated in Germany, and then they fled Hitler to come to America. And in fact, the entire impetus for the atomic weapons program, the Manhattan Project, was refugees worrying that what if Hitler got the atomic bomb and we didn't have it, which is a fair frightening thing to consider. But anyway, so but this amazing story is that the co-inventor of the atomic bomb and the co-inventor of the hydrogen bomb and the co-inventor of the modern computer and the co-inventor of the fissile fuel that makes up atomic power and atomic bombs all come from Hungary. Now, my favorite of the four is Johnny von Neumann, who we know is for many, many things. He's the one who came up with the idea that you could use binary code for both the programs and the data in a computer. His wife, Clary, programmed the first one. Since the most popular computer of the day was called ENIAC, he called his computer MANIAC. he was such a snazzy dresser that he wore a three-piece pinstripe suit to go burro riding in the Grand Canyon with a bunch of guys from Los Alamos. And there's a famous corner in Princeton where he frequently crashed his car because Johnny liked to read a book while driving at the same time. So you see, so for all of you who like texting, maybe you'll get a corner name for you too someday. So
you have to run into it, though.
Yeah, so he's my favorite. But Leo Szilard, who co-invents the atomic bomb, is also a wild character. He spends most of his life in a bathtub thinking up ideas. And then, of course, there's Edward Teller, who's sort of like the Iago of atomic history. He reappears again and again and again. He introduces Ronald Reagan to Star Wars most recently. But my favorite story about Ed Teller is that when he first got the idea for having a fusion bomb instead of a fission bomb, a thermonuclear or a hydrogen bomb instead of a uranium bomb, he started thinking of all of the bomb ideas that he wanted to build. And my favorite Teller bomb idea was one called the backyard bomb. And it was called that because it was so huge and it would kill so many people. You didn't need to take it and drop it on your enemy. You could just set it off in your backyard.
A science experiment.
Uh-huh.
Well, if you'd like to call in this morning, our toll-free number, 800-838-3760. We have Michael calling in from Klamath County. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. They brought up dark matter, and I wondered if the radiation of that permeates everything around and among us, just like it does with the regular radiation. It's just like that. And also, things like E=mc², conversion of matter to energy, energy to matter, does that apply to that sort of thing? What do they know yet? Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, I don't know about dark matter, but I can tell you a fantastic E=mc² story, which is the fact that there's a woman named Lisa Meitner, who was the first female university professor in the history of Germany. She ran the physics department of the world's leading research institute for a dozen years, and then she was driven out of Germany by the Nazis and ended up in Sweden as a refugee. She couldn't speak Swedish, and her new boss hated her, and her career, which was her whole life, was essentially over. And she's 60 years old, and it's Christmas Day 1938, and her nephew has come to visit her. And they have a dinner of lutefisk, which, for those of you who do not know, is basically like the beef jerky you get at a 7-Eleven, except it's made from fish, and it has the consistency of Jell-O. And it's the worst thing I ever put in my mouth, and I have put tarantula legs in my mouth, so there you are. So after they have that dinner, they go for a walk in the snow, and they're very confused because Lisa's ex-partner, villainous chemist Otto Hahn, is having problems because every time he bombards uranium with neutrons, he keeps getting barium, which is way down the periodic table and not right next to it, which is what they expected to get, and so he thinks something is wrong with his instruments. And Lisa sits down with a piece of paper and a pencil, and she thinks about Niels Bohr's water droplet idea of the atomic nucleus, and she thinks about, what if uranium was being cut in half and you ended up with barium, where would the rest of it go? And she applied E=mc², and she discovered fission.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, as you look at the history of this, it seems like just in the years, it's still a relatively young science. When you talk about, we didn't even know about neutrinos until what, or neutrons until the 1930s, is that correct?
Exactly, exactly, exactly. You know, the X-ray was, X-rays is 1895. So everything is really, it's only in 100 years. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of incredible how fast science can move once it goes, you know. We went from the Wright brothers to landing on the moon, which is my last book, in 66 years. So essentially we went from someone finding X-rays to atomic bombs and power plants in 50 years.
On the line is Brad in Ashland. Go ahead, Brad.
Yes, thanks. Lovely program. I'm really interested in answers to two very different kinds of questions. The first has to do with, I had heard that the Eisenhower administration's Atoms for Peace program, creating nuclear plants to provide electricity to the country, was a covert way of, ironically, creating bomb fuel, to create fuel for the atomic bombs. That's one thing I'd like to have clarified. And the other than the other.
No, let me answer that one. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
Eisenhower
created
that program so his legacy wouldn't be only atomic buildup. But they didn't need to use that to make atomic bombs because they're making plenty of atomic bombs elsewhere. But go ahead.
So they were making that Savannah River.
Yes, Savannah River, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Washington, Hanford, Washington.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And the other is there's the former head of NASA, James Hansen, got pushed out of that for talking about global warming when people didn't want to hear about it. And he's considered an expert in that field. But one of the things he recommends now, he says that our renewables, solar and wind and so forth, won't keep up with the demand for electricity. And he suggests that we should look at what he calls generations 3 and 4 of nuclear reactors, which, according to him, have not been built yet, but in design would not be as dangerous as our former nuclear reactors. And is that true, and is there hope that nuclear power can be created safely?
Well, I absolutely pray he's right. There's a great deal of research going on in the next generation of nuclear right now. China is hoping to come up with something called a pebble bed reactor, where the core, the uranium, is stored within a graphite pebbles so it can't melt down. Bill Gates has put his money on something called a traveling water reactor, which is a very tiny modular style unit. People in the south of France are working on something called ITER, which is this giant fusion project to take the power that's inside the sun and turn it into a power for energy. And there are various other people working on breeder reactors, which are the generations Hansen was talking about. So I pray that one of these things will happen, because right now, even though I think that nuclear is better for human health than petroleum or coal or natural gas because of fracking, every time there's been an accident, the government and industry has reacted so poorly that we just don't trust them anymore. So that's why I say that we're in the twilight of the nuclear age.
You know, Brad touched on the question, and I was going to ask it if no one did, but kind of just as a follow-up to that, I know some prominent environmentalists, I don't want to get it wrong, but I think Stuart Brand, among others, have recommended some kind of small-scale nuclear, or like a nuclear stopgap, until we can ramp up and bring things like solar and wind energy up to an actual doable level. And some of these articles I've read suggest that that may actually be a few hundred years before that could happen. And I wondered if you had touched on, if you'd read anything about that.
Yes, I really hope that that's where we turn. But right now, the United States is actually frozen. We're not developing nuclear at all here because of the coincidence that we had our Three Mile Island meltdown at the same time as the movie The China Syndrome was in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to say that Americans learned about nuclear power from that coincidence, because even though, in fact, the safety features of Three Mile Island work and no one was actually contaminated from it, the movie was such a thrilling ride and had so many analogies to what was going on in Pennsylvania that it created the biggest public demonstration in American history when 1 million gathered for a No Nukes concert. And so American electricity provided by nuclear was 20% then, and that's still where it is today, 20%. But we really need to do something about this, because I know that many people on the West Coast are concerned that Fukushima radiation is going to travel across the Pacific and infect them. But in fact, that is not going to happen. That's just not possible to be worried about that. But what they can be worried about is the fact that air pollution is traveling from China across and is already in California as we speak.
And the Fukushima situation, I just read, and maybe it was in your book, I can't remember, but they're starting to ramp up nuclear again in Japan, aren't they?
Well, they don't really have a choice. And I don't know, I haven't heard the latest from Germany, but I don't know that they're going to have a choice either. The problem is that right now in the United States, we have these huge natural gas reserves that we're exploring. So we don't have an energy issue because natural gas is so cheap. But Japan has to either import coal and oil, or it can run nuclear plants. And to say that, because of this one accident, we should shut down half of our power and everyone should pay 10 times as much is a problem for them. So people sit, when they hear me say these things, they think I'm trying to defend nuclear. And to me, it's a choice between the devil and the deep blue sea. Saying it's better than coal and petroleum and natural gas isn't exactly saying it's terrific.
Jeannie is on the line from Medford. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Hi, I'm glad to hear you say that about Fukushima. Bill Wattenberg always says when people call in his show, you probably get more radiation from the person sleeping next to you. But I want to say, when I worked in 1967 at Fort Worth Osteopathic Hospital, needed a summer job, and my uncle happened to be a radiologist, so I got a little job in learning how to, in those days, pre-computer, develop x-rays in the dark room, like a real photographer with a dark room and a red light, and these heavy metal, maybe they were lead, jackets with the film, and all the technicians wore these, besides a name badge, a badge that measured how much radiation exposure they had had, and if it got too high, you had to back off. And I always wondered why the patients didn't have those badges. They got x-rays over and over.
Well, that's a very good question, and that's a very good point you raised. In fact, at Fukushima, the workers, if their dosimeters went off too high, they wouldn't be allowed to work in the nuclear industry anymore. So they left a lot of them off when they went into work on the plant. But anyway, back to your question. The issue is that the radiologists are being exposed over and over again, and unless you are having a very extreme health problem where you're getting radiation from different sources, you're not under a problem. The patients don't have a problem unless they don't have a general physician who's monitoring, and they're getting diagnostics and treatment from multiple things, and no one is paying attention to the cumulative effect.
Steve is on the line from Eugene. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes. First, I'd like to talk about the three nuclear tragedies, so-called, that we've had, and give you my opinion about them. First is Whitewater, and I call Whitewater a red herring to use against nuclear power, which does not contribute to global warming. Whitewater was is a red herring. I don't know if anybody has died from Whitewater's leaking of radiation. And the second one I want to talk about is Chernobyl. I think that was just a prime example of Soviet haste to catch up with the West, and they built a plant that was inferior, and that nothing like that will ever happen in the United States. And the third one, Fukushima, well, that shows what happens when you build a plant on the coast, and we shouldn't build plants on the coast where they can be interrupted by a tsunami. And my further comment is that in Europe, there are hundreds of nuclear plants spread all over the place. The one problem, perhaps, that exists is what to do with the nuclear waste, and I would like to know what the Europeans are doing with the nuclear waste. I think people are afraid of nuclear power because they can't see the radiation. We lose about 20,000 or 30,000 people a year to automobile crashes and collisions, but nobody wants to get rid of the automobile because we can see what it is. So there's a certain amount of mystery about nuclear power, which we ought to be able to dispel and get people to see that nuclear power, expensive as it is worthwhile pursuing because of global warming possibilities. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Well, you brought up a very interesting point about Chernobyl, which is not that the technology was worse than the United States, but it did what the man who was asking about Atoms for Peace thought, is that the Soviets used Chernobyl to make both plutonium for atomic warheads and electricity for the citizens of Kiev. In order to do that, they had to use a removable shell for the top of it, and they did not have the containment dome that the United States has on its nuclear plants. So when Chernobyl blew up and had an atomic fire raging for 2 weeks, it sent a cloud the size of 400 Hiroshimas across all of Europe. So that was an unusual incident. And, of course, the trick with Fukushima, the big flaw in it was they had their backup batteries in the basement. If they hadn't done that, it would have survived the tsunami.
I'm assuming that Fukushima is located where it is because of the access to water that they need for the plants, for the cooling. Is that correct?
Well, there's a long story about how the Japanese put a lot of them on the shoreline because, yes, they needed the water for the cooling, but also at that time it was like New York City originally. The waterway was where all the sailors were and all the industry was, and refined people didn't go by the water. So during that period, there wasn't a lot of human beings living near these waterways where they constructed these plants.
Our guest today is Craig Nelson, and his new book is entitled The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. We're taking your questions and comments today, and you can reach us anywhere in the state of Jefferson, the listening area, at 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, Medford and Ashland, 541-552-6782. Or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org, and we will do our best to get to your questions. We'll be back with Craig Nelson and more of your comments right after this short break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Milt Radford, filling in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're speaking with Craig Nelson, the best-selling author of a number of books. His latest is The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. We do have a caller on the line, I believe. Hello, go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead with your question.
Oh, okay. I heard that the U.S. agency, whatever agency is responsible for setting standards, raised a tolerable level of radiation in the coastal water after Fukushima. And also that the other question is, I understand that there's been a lot of seafood found in our marketplace that has higher radiation levels than would be tolerable. Is that so?
Oh, well, first of all, it wasn't the U.S. government that raised the radiation levels. It was the Japanese. And they did that to not have to replace all their workers. But it's disturbing. It may be the seafood is higher, but it would have to be astronomically higher for it to be a health risk. It's not anything to worry about.
A lot of our food is radiated anyway, isn't it?
Well, it has radioactive from various reasons. In fact, one of the great ironies of all this story is that the fact that the radioactive testing that the United States did at the Nevada test site during the Cold War is so extensive that it has blanketed the entire continental United States with radioactive waste, and it now 11,000 Americans die every year because of that. So all that time we were worried about the Soviets bombing us. In fact, we needed to worry about Washington.
Jamie from Medford just wants to know about thorium use in nuclear power.
Oh, yes, that's right. One of the earlier questions was, what's the difference between Europe and the United States? And another avenue of research is thorium, which is part of a series called breeder reactors, which are a fascinating technology where as the reactor uses up its fuel, the fuel breaks down and becomes more fuel for the reactor, which is amazing. But the one question I didn't answer from earlier is about storage of radioactive waste. And the issue is that European forms of fuel rods are recycled, so they break it down and have much less than America, which has a national policy of not recycling its fuel because they're afraid that it will be stolen by communists or terrorists.
I read somewhere that France, more than 70% of their power comes from nuclear. And there's quite a few countries, as you mentioned earlier, that where they're sort of either forced into it or by choice they've decided to go that way. Why has the United States decided not to go that direction? Is it because of the cheap natural gas and things like that?
The French have almost the exact opposite attitude in the general population as we do in the United States. The French think nuclear is chic and sophisticated and elegant and clean, and they have an energy surplus because of it, and they never have to worry about the Middle East or any of these other issues because of that, and they think we're naive and childish that we don't feel that way. In America, however, Elizabeth Colbert, who wrote Six Extensions, she said, we never met a hydrocarbon we didn't like. So we like having cheaper electricity regardless of the long-term costs. And in this particular case, we now have a situation where nuclear power plants are very expensive to build, so they need taxpayer support for that. They are more expensive than using coal and natural gas and petroleum, so they need kilowatt-hour subsidy for that. And then if something happens, they need taxpayer dollars to fix that. So it's become a political issue, and I don't know how many Americans want their money going to them.
You can't put nuclear energy yet, I guess, in cars. I'll date myself a little bit here, but in the early 1960s, when I was in elementary school and you go to the school library, there was all these wonderful books, which have sort of become cheesy collector items now, but supposedly by this point in time, we were going to be driving nuclear cars and flying around in nuclear private planes and everything. We had a very different attitude back in the middle of the last century about nuclear power, didn't we?
Well, my favorite of all that was a spaceship that was designed, in fact, by Freeman Dyson, and it was the shape of an orb, and the crew set up in a little lead-lined cabin up at the front, and then atomic explosions would fill the orb, which would shoot out of a little hole of the back, and basically the entire thing was engineered to have the best shock absorbers you ever saw in your life because of using this for power. But unfortunately, after they finally figured out how to make it work, they suddenly realized, well, there would be radioactive exhaust every time the rocket took off from the Earth, so that was a problem.
Didn't quite work so well.
Yeah.
We have Paul on the line from Grants Pass. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, good morning. Fascinating discussion. One thing that I talked with a retired physicist about who has been monitoring the Rogue Valley, he indicated to me that post-Fukushima radiation, background radiation levels are about three times higher than they were before Fukushima. But he had indicated that this wasn't a significant problem and wouldn't become a significant problem. And I've forgotten, I was looking for input from you at how many times background does radiation become a significant problem for an adult, and at what point does a background radiation become a significant problem for children? The other piece of this, I'd like you to discuss the concentrating effect of the food chain and higher predators on the long-term impact of long-lived radiation in the Pacific.
Well, to answer your first question is that your background radiation right now is in the couple of hundreds, and it needs to get up to around 100,000 rems to be a problem. And the only way you can get there is by smoking cigarettes. Or I guess if a naked pregnant woman off the fishing and off the shores of Fukushima, I wouldn't recommend that. But other than that, you really have to go out of your way to have that happen. Secondly, the concentration is an issue with mercury much more than it is with radiation. So I don't think that's an issue either. But finally, the one thing that isn't being discussed is I'm quite sure that the Fukushima radiation is going to enter their water table, and I do think they're going to have to abandon that territory and not try and have people living there.
Hmm. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about Los Alamos. We haven't touched on that, and give us a little brief overview, well, brief if you can say that, about that project.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the entire impetus for entering the first atomic race for between the Russians and the U.S. for who would make the first atomic bomb happened because of people fleeing Hitler. So we like to tell that story as Robert Oppenheimer and Albert Einstein did some calculations and voila, the bomb. But in fact, it required three of the most dangerous scientific experiments in American history to make those bombs work. The first is one of my favorite experiments of all time, where Enrico Fermi decided to test the first nuclear reactor. And he was supposed to do it at a facility built for him in the Argonne Forest. But the contractors struck, and so he had to find someplace else to do it. And the University of Chicago said, well, you know, we don't have football here anymore, so we've abandoned our football stadium, so you can use that. And he goes in and he finds this squash court. And Fermi begins the first nuclear power plant, first nuclear reactor in history. He runs in the middle of the city of Chicago, which, you know, is very alarming. But anyway, it came off perfectly. And the very funny ending to that story is the fact that he did it in this squash court. Well, the translation from the Soviet spies went back to Moscow a little off. And for something like three decades, the Soviet Union thought the first atomic reactor took place in a pumpkin patch.
That's great. Well, for the folks who, you know, today is, do we see a bigger threat from rogue states and from terrorist organizations, dirty bombs, those kind of things? Is that a bigger threat today than some sort of large scale nuclear type attack?
Well, over and over again, we always get alarmed when a new crazy person seems to get an atomic bomb. So we got scared when Stalin got it. We got scared when Mao got it. We got scared when the Kim family in Korea got it. And now we're getting scared because the Iranians are going to get one, you know. So every single time it happens, but the only people who have ever used atomic bombs in warfare is us. So it seems to be something that you really only use to sort of wave around, and no one ever actually does it. So there's that. There's the rogue state issue. The terrorist issue is the fact that the biggest attack on American soil was conducted with box cutters. So to imagine that they would go from box cutters to nuclear physics is sort of a big leap. But I do think there is a terrible issue in the fact that we have these spent fuel rods sitting in cooling tanks sitting around at a dozen sites in America. And then we have this immense transportation network of nuclear arms and nuclear fuel going on between weapons labs and weapon sites and fuel sites and atomic power plants. And I think those two things have a terrorist potential, but not an actual dirty bomb.
We're speaking with Craig Nelson, the best-selling author of Rocket Men. His new book is entitled The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. What exactly do you mean by the fall of the atomic era?
Well, I think we're in the twilight. I think that, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union spent $5.5 trillion on atomic weapons, which have never been used since Nagasaki. And at some point, people are going to say, why do we even bother with this stuff? And it's just absurd. And we'll think of atomic weapons as being like the trebuchet or the blunderbuss. It'll just be old-fashioned, and we'll still have them. They won't be gone for good, but they'll be insignificant. And I think unless we have one of these technological breakthroughs we've been talking about, the same is true for nuclear power, because they have done such a terrible job handling the accidents in the aftermath. They don't educate people. They aren't transparent. They aren't forthcoming. They don't make anyone feel safe and secure. They do pretty much the exact opposite of everything they should be doing. So I think we're seeing the twilight of both nuclear power and nuclear arms, and that's why I thought it was time to write this book.
A friend of mine and I were talking about the 1980s and how everyone was so concerned during the Cold War about nuclear proliferation and the possibility of war, and we don't talk about it much. And his opinion was, I don't know why we're worried about global warming. We still have enough weaponry to wipe out all life on Earth in a very short period of time. I mean, is that a correct assessment or not? Do we still have enough nuclear warheads out there to cause total destruction, annihilation?
Oh, absolutely we do. One of the great ironies in the book is the fact that Kennedy's scientific advisor explains how we could easily wipe the civilization off of any continent with about 300 nuclear weapons. And at that time in 1963, America had 23,000 nuclear weapons. And we have a lot more than that now. In fact, Barney Frank, before he left Congress, was trying to get the government to give up one of its three nuclear divisions. We have nuclear bombs on missiles inside silos, the Minuteman missiles. We have nuclear bombs on submarines. And we have nuclear bombs in bombers. And he was asking them to give up one of them because it would save something like $8 billion a year, which they would not do. So we still have this thing that we're spending over, I think, $12 billion a year on, which is an atomic arsenal directed against the Soviet Union when there is no more Soviet Union.
Well, you know, with the politics and geopolitical situations changing all the time, Crimea and that kind of thing, is this the sort of thing where us and the Russians want to keep these weapons as a just-in-case type of scenario?
Well, the Russians don't have them anymore. We're the only ones who have them,
and still have them.
We keep them as a just-in-case scenario. Mm-hmm.
So the future of nuclear power, just kind of in the last minute or so that we have left, do you think the United States will be forced to adopt a more nuclear position and build some smaller scale, safer reactors?
No, I think there's going to be a war between who wants to frack and who doesn't. So unless we have one of these technological breakthroughs that we're all hoping for, I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay, so the book is entitled The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Again, this is written by Craig Nelson, best-selling author of Rocket Men. Do you have a focus, a book that you're working on now? Did you want to preview?
Yes, but I'm not allowed to say. But my website is craignelson.us, so anyone who wants to get in touch with me or read an excerpt or hear part of the audio or read a conversation or any of those things can do it. So there, craignelson.us.
And how long did you spend working on this book?
5 dog years.
5 dog years.
Yes,
a
exactly.
Long time.
Okay. I work like 2 dogs in the yard, baby.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today, and best of luck with your next endeavor.
Thank you, sir.
Once again, you've been listening to the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio, and you can find out more about our program and subjects, and you can suggest a guest also at jeffexchange.org. We also provide some show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available also on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, Here and Now is coming up next, and if you're listening in the evening to our rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. The Exchange is produced by the JPR Foundation as a public service to Jefferson Public Radio. The producer of The Exchange is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Milt Radford. Thanks for listening. Jeffrey Riley will be back tomorrow.